Welcome to Warning Shot, a new look at foreign policy with your hosts, Joel Rubin, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, and Endy Zemanides, Executive Director of the Hellenic American Leadership Council. Now here's Joel and Endy.
Russia.
Welcome back to Warning Shot. Endy Zemanides with Joel Rubin. Almost a month into Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's war. It's war of aggression. I'm going to use every word that's outlawed in Russia. Ukraine leaked some documents that they captured from the Russians showing that they fully expected and Putin fully expected this war to be over in 12 days. More than 12 days later, Joel, why is this war still going on?
Arrogance, hubris, and a complete miscalculation by Vladimir Putin, A, of Russia's strength, and B, of Ukraine's weakness, and C, of the West's resolve. And frankly, Vladimir Putin is now stuck in a quagmire. They are in a quagmire. And that never ends well for the aggressor. The aggressors get caught in this psychological trap of we invaded, we have to win, we can't win, but we can't give up. We can't look weak. So that is now where Russia is. The danger is that they have a tremendous quantity of firepower and they're just hammering in the most inhumane, human rights violating way possible cities, turning them into rubble right before our eyes and to no real end, no real end game, just pummeling a country. And now we hear reports of the Russians taking Ukrainian civilians, putting them on trains, sending them to the gulag in Siberia. Really? Is this 1920?
Getting rid of their Ukrainian papers, trying to de-Ukrainianize parts of Ukraine. And going back to your turning cities into rubble, the Greek consul general of Mariupol, where there was a large ethnic Greek population who stayed to the last minute trying to evacuate people, landed in Greece just yesterday and said, I've seen stuff that none of you will have ever seen. He compared what's going on to Mariupol to Aleppo. And we saw that schools and hospitals being shelled and hypersonic missiles being used. Is this a show of his weakness, Joel, or his strength?
Well, you know, Andy, the massive scale of the humanitarian crisis here is just so overwhelming that it does show a weakness. But let's just talk about numbers for a second here. The UN just revised its estimates. It now says that over 6 million people have been internally displaced. That means they're Ukrainians inside of Ukraine, but not where they live, in their homes. And then another 3.5 to 4 million as refugees. That means Ukrainians outside the borders.
That's a quarter of Ukraine's population.
A quarter of Ukraine's population, 10 plus million people in a month, in 1 month. This is the single fastest, quickest a humanitarian crisis in my lifetime. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. It's a modern military bombarding in an unprovoked manner civilian areas in order to win a war. They can't win the military war. It's clear. It's obvious. They do not have the ability to militarily subdue Ukraine. So what they are trying to do is essentially destroy the country's civilian population to get the president to quit. That's like a thief coming into your house. You have an alarm, you have a gun, you defend yourself. So then they just shoot your family instead to try to get you to quit. I mean, this is like the most grotesque of all things. And I think, of course, yes, to your question, it does evince weakness, but there's still violence and pain and power that Vladimir Putin is projecting. It's sort of like a locked in dilemma that we're in now. We're caged in here now, and how to get out of this cage. Let me ask you.
We got to get a psychological profiler on soon, because there's a lot to these analyses I believe there's a lot more than people are giving to these analyses of Putin being isolated. And in fact, again, credit to this administration leaking every piece of intelligence that they got, probably rattled Putin. There were reports that he, as a result, he did not give even his military planners his plans until the very last moment. And if that's how you're running a war, that's not a recipe for success. You're leaking to the Chinese.
But let me ask you, there's something that I really want you to help us to understand, which is, what is he then going to do? What is he trying to get? There are reports that he's saying in negotiations he wants Ukraine to be neutral. What does that even mean? And
I'm going to leave the neutrality towards the end, because there's a hard power component. And if we look at the map, this is something that's been at play as far back as the original invasion of Crimea, a land bridge between the Donbas region. Back in 2014, a land bridge between the Donbas region and Crimea. And that explains a lot of what's going on in Mariupol right now. If they capture Mariupol, if you look at where they're drawing back to, they're actually retreating back to the east. There's this little red crescent being formed in the eastern and southeastern borders of Ukraine. And maybe that's where his end game is for now. Or it could be that this is a tactical retreat to do a second wave of an invasion. Of course, it's mud season right now. There's a reason everybody was expecting the invasion when they did, because that was peak freeze. There are pictures of tanks getting stuck in the mud. The ground offensive.
In the ones that weren't taken away by tractors, by farmers. Right.
And the ground offensive is infinitely harder right now, which makes bombardments, hypersonic missiles, this show of force that you referred to before, a much more dangerous prospect.
You know, I think this idea that Russia, that Putin can carve up a country, right, can take the eastern chunk or a chunk of the east and label it Russia and then say, okay, I'm done. That could be a thing where the Russians argue that they have achieved their objectives, their military objectives have been accomplished, and now they want to stop the war. They want to have an agreement with Zelensky. I don't think Zelensky is going to buy that. I don't think the Ukrainian people, after 8 years of fighting this ongoing conflict, this ongoing war of attrition with Russia, are suddenly going to say, sure, keep that chunk. You know, we've seen in Europe, when countries take chunks of other countries, they usually find ways to continue to go forward rather than backward. It isn't like a one-shot deal and now Russia will have a peace treaty with Ukraine. And so to me, there's a bigger picture behind all of this. There's this immediate hard power military battle. And then there's the big picture about where will we be 3 to 5 years out? And Zelensky, you know, he's the leader now. He's leading the fight. He frankly probably mobilized and motivated the Ukrainian people in a way that they may not have realized they could do so themselves. But by his presence and his engagement, turned on the Ukrainian zeitgeist, and now there they are. How important is Zelensky to this going forward? What role do you see him playing? How is he mobilizing?
He changed the whole equation. There's no question. I mean, you even have right now, I forgot who was saying it this weekend, but someone came out publicly and said, well, had Trump taken the meeting with Zelensky, maybe history would have been different. He would have supported Ukraine. We would have armed Ukraine. Zelensky, we've talked about this first in earlier episodes, has emerged as a 21st century action hero. Even things, you can't underestimate a people's will to fight. And the fact that he does these briefings in military fatigues and the green military t-shirt. It actually almost makes me want to encourage Dwayne Johnson to run for president in 2024, because I'll tell you what, Vladimir Putin, if The Rock is the president of the United States, there will be no more Vladimir Putin shirtless photos. But Zelensky is winning the information battle. And that's the real importance. He's definitely rattling Vladimir Putin. He's making Vladimir Putin look a little weak. And again, that's a dangerous prospect. You know, when we had Nikos Tsafos on and we were talking about making Europe almost exclusively independent or entirely independent from Russia, making Russia look weak, making Russia lacking it completely out of the financial system and the energy system with Europe. That's something that I think we should pursue, but there's a downside to that. And this is why we got to, we don't know what's in Putin's head.
Well, you know, it's a moment to think about the difference between the leader and the country. And the hardest part is to disconnect the two in the moment of war, in a moment of crisis. But Vladimir Putin is leading his country into the abyss. I mean, this is the thing that really I found so astounding when Donald Trump called him a genius, and Mike Pompeo and Madison Cawthorn. And
remember that Zelensky is a thug. Remember the Ukrainian government is incredibly corrupt and it is incredibly evil and it has been pushing woke ideologies.
For some reason, these people think that it's really smart to invade another country and take it, which A, is diabolical, but B, how is it smart to destroy your own economy? How is it smart to get cut off from the rest of the world? How is it smart to have your military stuck in the mud and be killed in the thousands upon thousands by babushka-wearing Ukrainian grandmothers, right? Like, this is not smart. And so I don't think we'll ever see Vladimir Putin welcomed back again into the community of nations. If he still stays in power after this, he's done. He's persona non grata. He's Kim Jong-un.
We're hoping that, though. We're hoping that, Joel, you and I were in a presentation where former Secretary Pompeo made an observation that I hope we all took to heart. He said in 2014, the world was up in arms about Crimea. By 2016, nobody was talking about it. And that's kind of, you know, there's this idea. When this invasion happened, was this the end of the Pax Americana? I said that we're going to remember this day as the way we remember September 11th or February 24th, 2022 will be on par with September 11th. But there might be a new Pax Americana. This unity among the West, this accountability, and calling out, listen, you just said, well, you know, in Europe, there have never been invasions and people don't go forward. That's actually not true. That's not true. In 1974, Turkey invaded Cyprus and holds 37%. And now it's hilarious that the precedent for Crimea and Donbass, the precedent, which is in Ankara, is now trying to act as peacemaker and actually has put themselves forward as a guarantor of a peace. And the last time Turkey acted as a guarantor, they used their official rights as a guarantor to invade another country. So
go ahead.
Having said that, it is very important how we move forward as a West. We're reacting to a crisis. There's going to be a moment where the crisis is over. This is another important part about the Cyprus precedent. Cyprus doesn't get attention because it's not a hot war. And press people and people at the State Department have used the old adage on me, if it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead. We're talking about Ukraine right now in a way that we didn't talk about. And you and I have both said we've been fighting. There has been a war since 2014. But there hasn't been that much blood. When the bleeding stops, are we going to forget about this? And is that his way back in?
Well, you know, it's interesting. A couple of thoughts on it. First of all, I probably should have said on the landmass of Europe rather than, you know, because I know we're talking about an island there. But I appreciate the edit. But here's the thing. There are structures in place on sanctions that will require action to repeal. So that will not occur with Vladimir Putin running Russia unless Vladimir Putin completely changes his tune. They're not locked in, just like Syria sanctions, North Korea sanctions, Venezuela sanctions, Iran sanctions, you name it. When countries get sanctioned, there has to be an active choice to repeal that. And so that's why I think we're in this for the long haul with Putin. And going to the Zelensky comparison, Zelensky's briefing parliaments every other day. He basically has had more FaceTime with parliaments around the world than any global leader in living memory, right? Like, this is just abnormal. Zoom, it all comes together at the same time. And now he's briefing the whole world. That's astounding. But, you know, I think when it comes to paying attention, you're right. There really is a tyranny of the urgency. And in foreign policy, oftentimes, it's what's hot right now at that moment that gets the attention. It doesn't mean it doesn't get worked on. It doesn't mean that it's totally ignored. But presidential level attention is typically reserved for the crises. Foreign policy, in many ways, is a highly reactive sport in terms of putting out the fire and steering the ship. I remember when I worked at State, and in my early days, I was a desk officer. And I remember when the training came, they said, your job as a desk officer on this bilateral account with Egypt is to maintain the bilateral relationship. Full stop. Maintain the bilateral relationship. So the relationship could have 10 different issues. A new government could come in. Another one could go out. My job at State was to make sure that that relationship continued. Now, that is not a very emotionally satisfying position. And politically, gets you into all a bunch of hot water. But that's how the bureaucracy views their job, certainly in the foreign policy arena.
So I think it's less about the bureaucracy, isn't it? Isn't it about, you know, I want to talk about strategy, both
bureaucracy
externally and internally, our political party strategies, but as a country.
Yeah.
We haven't had, you know, when you were last in government, I think there was a good strategy, which was a pivot to Asia, but that got bogged down. It got bogged down first by the Arab uprisings. It got bogged down by
Crimea.
It got bogged down by Afghanistan. It got bogged down. And it seems to be getting bogged down again. Correct. And is there a grand strategy? And when we're talking about the end of one era of Pax Americana, does anybody, because this is where I'm a little queasy. Nobody's telling me what our end game is here. Is there a new Pax Americana? Are there new institutions? Is there a new theory of conflict prevention, a new unity among the West? Or does that end when the bleeding stops? And that's a conversation that I'd like to hear more of right now, because stopping Vladimir Putin is necessary but insufficient.
Yeah, I think what we've seen, certainly from the first year of the Biden team, is a commitment to reasserting American global leadership with a diplomatic emphasis. And so restoring alliances, historic alliances that really laid fallow during the Trump administration, or even if they didn't lay fallow, they felt like they were ignored, if not undermined. NATO comes to mind right away. A recognition that post-Iraq, the United States does not have unilateral power to militarily invade other countries, to impose our will. Bad idea on many levels, period. And then the big motivating theme for this administration was foreign policy for the middle class. The idea that you always talk about it, what happens over there affects us here. So like the breadbasket of the world is getting bombed by Russia. And that's going to affect wheat prices, and that's going to really harm people on the lower end of the economic scale. We may not feel it necessarily here in the United States as much, and certainly better off consumers, wealthier consumers won't feel it hardly at all. But billions of people are going to feel this war.
We feel the oil. It's the largest exporter of oil. So you know, we're independent or not,
together,
global market.
And so just to close the thought on this, the point is that I don't know if Pax Americana necessarily is the easiest way to define it, but certainly globalist Americana, and I like the word globalist. I do believe in that. I do believe that the idea that the world is connected, we are interconnected, be it through the internet, through our economies, through our health, our pandemics, I mean, you name it, we're interconnected. We have to think that way. And alliances and engagement is crucial. So stamping out these conflicts is also, it's the thing that can hold us back, right? It's like we're out, we're moving forward. And what can drag us back into the cave? It's this idea that war is somehow going to fix our problems. And to your point, we want to pivot to Asia, get out of Afghanistan. We're moving in that direction. And no, good old Russia comes in. Putin comes right back in and pulls us right back in to his death grip. That's the moment.
So, but on your point on globalism, I think one of the fairest points about globalism today is that it was more of a race to the bottom. And I think it remained that way. Maybe if you want to revive that term or a commitment to a global nature, do we go to the top? Because there was too much of an assumption. There was that insane theory by Thomas Friedman that two countries with the McDonald's would never go to war. It's been, ever since he wrote it, it keeps being wrong. Two countries that were in the Dell supply chain, we're never going to go to war. Again, that keeps getting disproven. Maybe we really need to raise the standards. There's a conflict between a values-based, or there's a seeming conflict between a values-based foreign policy and an interest-based foreign policy. And I think that's a false choice. I think you can bring it up to, because it's not, yes, there won't be, there's more gray than black and white when it comes to global politics. But globalism up to now has led the bad guys, has let the bad guys act with impunity. And then we never call them out. We never call them out. We only call them out when maybe a core national security interest is at stake. So hopefully, if there's a new Pax Americana with a new type of globalism, it comes with a true commitment to the rule of law, because that is not what globalism has been up to now.
Well, let me ask you this one thing that I want to really get at here, which is the role of identity in national security and foreign policy. Because what we're seeing with Putin right now is he is motivating and mobilizing his country based on an argument of identity, that Ukraine is part of the Russian culture, to the point where it's really, it's Russian. It's an identity question for him. And we're seeing some of the far right figures here in the United States who applaud Vladimir Putin, making very much identity based arguments, Christian or orthodoxy arguments, white supremacist arguments, arguments of somehow Vladimir Putin is standing up for us against the woke people. Like Madison Cawthorn made this insidious argument the other day about how basically Vladimir Putin doesn't tolerate wokeness in his country, and somehow identifying with that sort of extreme example of violent aggression as an identity turn on for him.
Yeah, but these people are intellectual frauds and dishonest, because they can talk about Christianity and the leaders of Christianity, the worldwide leaders. The Pope has been
right
unequivocal about this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The ecumenical patriarch, the Orthodox ecumenical patriarch, and the Russians are Orthodox, right? Yes. He has been unequivocal. There was a interfaith liturgy with the Greek Orthodox and the Ukrainian Orthodox and Ukrainian Catholics in New York just a couple of weeks ago. So the people who want to use it, you know, want to claim some Christian, want to pretend that they are in Christian solidarity, they're pretending. They're using it. They are pretending. Ukrainians are Christian too. Ukrainians are both Catholic and Orthodox. So, you know, I this is, again, we're not going to agree with former Secretary Pompeo on a lot, but I'm sure you wanted to clap when he talked about who in the Christian world is supporting the barbarians and who is not. And he used that to contrast Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew with the Russian patriarch, who's basically an arm of the old KGB.
And I think what's also – that's brilliant the way you said that. I think what's also really kind of inspiring for me as an American Jew is to see a Jewish Ukrainian with national pride as a Ukrainian leading his country in this fight and, you know, kind of demonstrating a very powerful diversity within Ukraine, an openness. There are historic wrongs that have got to be focused on and thought about, but there's also a future about Ukraine as well that he exemplifies. He sort of, I'll put on my Jewish lane here. He exemplifies the past and the future simultaneously. And, you know, his family survived the World War II from the Holocaust. His father, his grandfather fought the Nazis. There's a lot there. It's very rich. And that, to me, is also part of the clash, which is this idea of a totalitarian fascist on one hand and diversity on the other, clashing. So what side are you on? You meaning all of us. Are you with the fascists who believe in wiping out diversity and difference? Are you with those of us who live in a world that's complicated and rich and colorful and dynamic and diverse? And I think that's really also what's so deeply impactful about this clash that we're seeing right now. It really is a fascist attacking a democracy that's diverse in all of its forms.
And that you raise questions that form a great transition into loss in translation, because somebody will give you a third option, right? And you've heard this third option, which is, you don't have to take a side. Ukraine should be neutral, should be like Finland or Austria or Sweden. Let's forget that many of these countries now want to be in NATO, but let's examine this neutrality.
Strongest alliances.
And I said he's a strong guy.
Will you shut up, man?
А может быть просто тривиальной жадности.
So what do you think people have in mind when they say, when they argue for neutrality?
Well, if you're not Vladimir Putin and you're a normal human being, neutral would mean that you don't pick a side, that no side messes with you and you mess with nobody else. I don't think that's what Vladimir Putin has in mind. What do you think he has in mind?
Well, Vladimir Putin wants a sphere of influence, doesn't want NATO, doesn't want any, not only NATO coming up to his borders, doesn't want the European Union. Now, of course, NATO wasn't really on the table, so people can use the canard of NATO all they want. And the 2014 crisis and the invasion of Crimea was instigated by Ukraine getting closer to the European Union. It does look like Zelensky is willing to give away NATO. But the people who are arguing for neutrality, I think, are when you talked about Madison Cawthorn or Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think they're looking to be a little bit of to effectuate a Pontius Pilate type attitude. Let's wash our hands of Ukraine and everything will be peaceful because Russia is not going to feel threatened. The only way Russia is not going to feel threatened is if they have a puppet regime in Kyiv and know that they can control things that way.
But you know what, Andy, and this is the key point, is nobody was threatening Russia. And I think Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world, the Madison Cawthorns of the world, the people who are rooting for Vladimir Putin are not only ignorant of history and naive, but they're also, quite frankly, dangerous. They're dangerous to America's role in the world. They're dangerous to our national security. They encourage the thinking that Vladimir Putin personifies, which is that if I don't achieve what I want through dialogue or engagement, I will take it through force. And that is taking a strong hold in the GOP. And we need to talk about that first.
Yeah, I think it's causing a fissure in the GOP. I think this may be a comeback of some of the more traditional foreign policy, conservative internationalists, even the neocons are definitely not on this page. But there is an argument. There is a legitimate argument to say, yeah, NATO should be taken off the table. If we're not willing to send American troops, and if we were not even willing to allow a residual force in Afghanistan, would we be willing to risk an American city or American lives over Kyiv? Now, I think the one thing that I would never, ever take off the table is Ukraine's ability to become more European and join the European Union. That's what I think Putin was trying to prevent. That's the key, because Ukraine is a fledgling democracy. It's democratizing. We shouldn't paper over its flaws with corruption, with political retribution. But for it to reach its full potential as a democracy, yeah, it should be able to be part of the European community of nations. And there are options when you're talking about whether it's Finland or Austria. There's a great article in Foreign Affairs website by the first Trump Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, Wes Mitchell, who's definitely more in the internationalist crowd, who argued for fortified neutrality. Sure, they don't have to be in NATO, but they should be armed to the teeth, and they should have some security guarantees from Western partners.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, though. If Vladimir Putin wanted to undermine NATO, what he chose to do has had the exact opposite result. The paradox of this moment is that Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine has told all the countries in NATO they made a good bet by joining and by signing up, all the former Soviet Union states. And we are now in a moment where the roles of countries to decide their own fate are, it's going to be on the top of mind of policymakers going forward about sovereignty and this question of when do you make these decisions to join and not to join. I really don't believe we can see Ukraine making this decision with a loaded gun to its head.
And well, they're, unfortunately, it seems like they're giving it away, and even the people who are standing up to it. Chris Murphy was on Sunday.
I'm not sure about that.
That's going to be the NATO membership is going to be given away.
The NATO membership, though, and we should debate this some further, but the NATO membership was never even an ask. That's the irony here. There was never even an ask.
Yes, but it's going to be given away into the future. And that might, you know what?
Maybe, but
that might not be a bad thing if EU membership is back on the table. But that's something that's going to be discussed further on. I want to note that we were
before that, I'm going to say I do think when it comes to NATO membership, that is ultimately still Ukraine's choice. Right.
It is, but they're the ones right now. Zelensky is saying he'll give it away. So I
haven't heard him say he'll give that
well,
away.
Well, you got to rewatch the Sunday talk shows yesterday.
No, he didn't say
so
that.
So a shout out. Want to give our thoughts to Brian Karem, who is supposed to be on with us from leave. They're under fire. We're going to check in with him and report back to you, making sure he's okay. But keeping with our theme of what comes next, what's the new structure of Pax Americana or globalization or the international world order? At the end of last year, Ann Applebaum did a wonderful cover story on The Atlantic, said the bad guys are winning. We're going to look at some of the other bad guys, from Lukashenko to Erdogan in Turkey to Maduro to Xi Jinping, who might be taking advantage of this crisis, and to see how they're being dealt with or how we can deal with them in the future.
It's going to be good.
All right, Joel, look forward to seeing you later this week.
Absolutely, Andy.
Thanks for watching Warning Shot, a new look at foreign policy. Download the podcast wherever you find your podcast, and we'll see you next time.
Russia, Russia, Russia.